Welcome back to the Cyclist Magazine podcast. I'm your host, James Spender. And today, dear listeners, it is just me again, both in this little intro and in our interview this episode. My co-host, Will, Mr. Will Strickson, is, as we speak, in Japan, holed up in a hotel in Osaka. He went to go and see the famous cherry blossoms of spring, which were delayed by a little bit due to weather conditions, aka global warming. So I'm not sure how much of the cherry blossoms we'll got to see. But I do know that right now he's being reacquainted with his dinner. He has got a wee bit of food poisoning, apparently. So Will, whenever you listen to this, I hope you're either on your way to recovering or recovered. And I look forward to having you on the other side of this microphone very soon. But in the meantime, we've got a wonderful guest this episode, a slightly left-field guest as well, which I think lots of you will know the name of, but perhaps not in connection with cycling. It's DJ Spoonie, real name, bit of a pub quiz fact for anyone, John St. John Joseph, or Jonathan Joseph, or sometimes we've been conversing over email, JJ. But I chose to rock with DJ Spoonie for this particular episode. Spoonie is 53 and comes from Hackney. He kicked off his radio career in 1996 on a pirate radio station, London Underground FM, and ended up forming part of the Dream Team with, that's Dream, by the way, with a double E, with Mikey B, and that's Mikey with a double E, and Timmy Magic. That's a double M and an I for Timmy, as part of the Dream Team. And they were instrumental in setting up or helping to kind of propagate the UK garage scene back in the mid-90s. That led into a commercial radio gig at KISS and then slots on Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, then hosting the Weekend Breakfast Show. Some of you might remember that, 2003 to 2006. They were some good years. Used to listen to Spoonie of a morning when I should have been in lectures. Then he did the UK Garage Show, Rinse FM, lots of other gigs. Currently, he has The Good Groove on Radio 2, and he's standing in for, I think he's standing in still, he might be back, but he was standing in for Craig Charles. And has been doing a bit of a slot for Trevor Nelson as well. He's also did Strictly Come Dancing. So there's a link to another guest who's coming up on this show that we discuss in our interview, Krishnan Guru Murthy, another slightly left field guest, but very keen cyclist. But Spoonie also was awarded the BEM, the British Empire Medal for services to charity. He raised, I think, over 20 grand during COVID for the NHS and is involved in lots of charities and runs a charity golf tournament. He's quite a handy golfer anyway. But more recently, Spoonie, of course, got into cycling. A familiar story, had a leg injury and took to the bike as a form of rehab at the behest of his physio. And it really worked out for him. He recaptured that feeling that I think a lot of us got when we got back into bikes properly, probably in the last, you know, the Olympics was a big, big boom for people refinding their wheels and refinding that kiddie smile of being out on a bike, wind in your hair, or the wind through the vents in your helmet, because we must all be safe. And that has kept burning for Spoonie. So he is now a paid up Lycra wearing cyclist. And most recently, you may have seen his bike even appear in the cycling media press. He got given a Ribble, I think it's the Ultra SLR. So that's the top of the range Aero Ribble. And he got, because he's Spoonie, custom painted. And it's covered in lyrics from his favourite Prince song, which we also talk about in this interview. And I have to say, the interview is quite sprawling. We do get onto some strange and wonderful topics, including Dave Brailsford's appointment at Manchester United, which, as some people might know, is a football club. It's not even to do with cycling. And sports washing and greenwashing as kind of general topics. That's something we've touched upon in Cyclist magazine recently. The printed paper product, an in-depth deep dive into the Middle East and its kind of role in cycling and how its money is affecting the sport for good and sometimes less good reasons. But we kick off, of course, because this is a cycling podcast, with a chat about David Beckham. Why not? So without further ado, I'd like to welcome DJ Spoonie, aka JJ, to the show. I've just finished watching, I don't know if you've seen it, the David Beckham documentary.
I have, yeah.
On Netflix. Yeah, what did you reckon? I'm pretty late to the party. What did you think?
You know, I thought it was a great PR move for him. It wasn't so much a documentary in the true sense of what we'd call a documentary. It was something that was going to put him in a good light. And you know what? Fair play to him. He deserves to be put in a good light. Kind of subjects that they didn't really go into. But I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. But I'm a massive football fan anyway, so there was so much in that for me.
Yeah. Have you ever met Beckham?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Good guy. I heard a really good anecdote that you told on another podcast about meeting Michael Owen, who is notoriously known amongst football fans as, I think, like one of the most sort of level, let's say, men in the game. But you said, you know, he's an incredibly cool guy. He made everyone feel really at home. How's Beckham? Similar or a bit aloof?
No, exactly the same. I had the pleasure of DJing at his 31st birthday party. So I guess that, you know, he was always going to treat me well because he wanted people to dance at his party, right? But I flew out to Madrid and done both of his parties. He was at Real Madrid at the time. But that was really cool. It was always, he and Victoria were always really, you know, really nice to me.
Did you feel like your itchy fingers wanting to drop "You'll Never Walk Alone Again"? Which I saw you did at Old Trafford once, that's a bold move.
Yeah, I saved that for Old Trafford. I only needed to do that once. And I think Old Trafford was a better setting as well. Yeah. Actually. So, yeah, that was good fun. Now, David, at the time, he really loved his garage, his hip-hop and his R&B, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of the era. But this is the strange thing, and I know it's a bit of a weird place to start off from, being as though we're a cycling podcast, we're already talking about football. But I was watching it yesterday with my partner, and this little bit popped out to me where the Sun newspaper, back in like Beckham's like massive pomp, tries to find the one guy they say on the planet who's never heard of Beckham. And it's like this goat herd from Timbuktu or something.
What a waste of resource, right?
What a waste of resources. But I found this like strange parallel occurring to me, which is I've told a lot of people that I'm going to be interviewing you on the podcast, and they've said DJ Spoonie, and they all know you in a way that's not a million miles away, like kind of like in that kind of like fabric of our upbringing. I'm 39. You've been on the radio since big mainstream radio since 2000s. But each person said something different. You know, Spoonie, the garage DJ. Spoonie, he's on Radio 1. Recently, Spoonie's filling in for Scott Mills. And then I started doing some digging. And you're also, you know, you've done loads of stuff for charity. I think you're a pretty good golfer. Run your own golf tournament. And, yeah, a BEM, which is the British Empire Medal, right? So services to charity. And then I start thinking, why is this guy taking up cycling? Because bloody hell, you seem really busy. And cycling's like the biggest time drain of a sport that there could possibly be.
I'm not sure. I'm a golfer. I think golf even more time than cycling. I've just loved cycling. And I kind of fell into it because almost literally I had a bad knee from running. Got myself quite fit. And as you get older, you realise it takes ages to get fit and not that long to get unfit. So I was really aware that I didn't want to sort of lose the conditioning that I'd built up. And then once my knee got to the point where I could do a little bit of exercise, and I knew I wasn't going to go and run on it for now, I went on the bike. I know a lot of, you know, people who've played football, and a part of their rehab, especially when they've had knee operations, is swimming and cycling. So I'd always enjoyed sort of getting on the bike beforehand, but I thought, right, now I'm going to do this as a form of rehab and exercise, as opposed to just having it as a mode of transport. And that's where it started. You know, went out on a couple of, you know, decent long rides for me anyway. It's always relative. Got whooped once, twice on one ride at the traffic lights by somebody. And I thought I had a decent bike, and I was like, right, that's it. I need to change my bike. This is nothing to do with my lack of power.
Absolutely not.
This is all to do with a bike. So, and that's where it started, really.
What was that? What was that bike? Was it the sort of, you know, you'd like, right, I'm going to get into cycling, and then you just go down to, I mean, if you're knocking around in London, Pearson Cycles, or, you know, one of the big bike shops, to go and grab something swanky.
You know, I have this thing of, so I bought my first two really nice bikes I'd bought used. They were secondhand, because I thought that you'd actually, if you get a bike that's looked after, you'd get much better value for money in that way. That was my theory. I'm not sure if it's entirely true, actually. I saw something the other day on GBN talking about a similar situation, but I managed to, my first sort of really nice bike was a Pinarello Dogma, which I never would have been able to afford or didn't really want to invest that amount of money into something that I didn't know if I'd be into it in a year or 2 years. Yeah. So I thought that was really good value. And I thought if I didn't really enjoy cycling at the end of that period, I'd be able to sell it and get most of my money back. But I loved it. I loved that Pinarello. I still got it. And then not too long after that, I bought myself, I got a Trek as well, which was really nice. So, yeah.
And what's your sort of process when you're buying a secondhand bike? Are you squeezing the brake levers first, squeezing the tyres first, picking it up first? What are you looking out for?
General overall condition, just to see if it's, does it look like it's been looked after? Any rust, any obvious rust, how clean it is. Obviously, it's easy just to clean the bike, but checking the tyres, see if the tyres have been maintained recently. That those bikes were both rim brakes, so you're able to see if the, you know, if the brakes are worn. And those kind of things give you a general idea of how well the bike has been looked after. Obviously, you try and look for any cracks, but it's really hard to see those. But yeah, I've been lucky with the bikes, and neither of the bikes I've bought have split in half when I've been going up.
So when was that then? When was the injury?
The injury would have been like 2019, early 2020, I think.
Okay. So were you ending up, you suddenly found yourself cycling on really empty roads because of lockdown and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit surreal I was living in North London in Hornsey and being able to just cycle up to Marble Arch and back in under an hour, 40 odd minutes and coming back down Oxford Street. So used to do it in a bit of a loop where I'd go sort of through Camden on the way, Holloway Camden on the way out, but I'd get up to Marble Arch and then go down Oxford Street because you just never get to really drive it or ride it from one end to the other. And it was eerie. No one on the road, really. Few cyclists. That was about it.
Yeah, no, I totally dig on the Oxford Street bit. I was living in London at the time and it was kind of eerie and magical. And anyone that knows Oxford Street, doesn't know Oxford Street, it's very long and there are loads of traffic lights. And so like on a regular day, it takes ages to get down it. But it's just mad, isn't it? It's like riding around London where you're free and London's like, wow, this is literally the best city on earth when there's no traffic. It's incredible.
It was as close to feeling like I had wings and I was flying as ever, because you're able to, you know, get good speed and keep the consistent speed and maintain that because you're not constantly stopping and cars pulling out and all of the stuff that happens when you drive around a big city or ride around a big city. And I suppose just being on the same roads on a bike that I would usually or typically be in a car, it felt completely, completely different. And a few cars that were on the road, because you're able to get good speed and the cars are restricted by speed limits, I was actually beating them over the distances. So, yeah, it was really nice. That was quite special, actually, riding around London when the roads are closed, or they weren't closed, but, yeah, riding around London when there's not so many cars was really cool.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to sort of sound disparaging towards cyclists. I'm absolutely one. But I reckon that even now, whether or not a cyclist is cool is, the jury's out. And once upon a time, when I took up road cycling fairly late in life in my 20s, and it definitely was still a bit of a kind of like weird niche thing. You're a guy that is ostensibly very cool, right? You kicked off, helped kind of like propagate and grow the UK garage scene. You were doing pirate radio back in the 90s. What do you reckon like mid-20s DJ Spoonie says about, you know, Spoonie in 2024 when he sees you getting on your Lycra and riding around on the Pinarello Dogma?
You know, the thing is that I've always been a bit of a sports fanatic anyway, and always appreciated the levels that people go to get to the top of their sport and maintain it. The other side of that conversation, I've always felt that really the epitome of being cool is just being yourself, just doing what you like, not really restricting yourself on what other people deem to be right or cool. So I never ever considered it as like, you know, this is my kit that I need to perform the best that I can when I'm on my bike. Just like when I'm going golf, you have, you know, certain golf shoes, or you wear tops that you can move in that can keep you warm, or playing football, you're having the right studs for the right grass or right surface. So yeah, I never ever thought about it like that. And actually what has happened is that I've got so many other people into cycling, because they're like, well, you know, if it's all right for him, then yeah, and there's no stigma involved or associated then. But I love it, you know, I love it. We've got a little cycling group, and yeah, it's golden, man.
Yeah, wicked. And recently, I think people, you know, cyclists, people in the cycling industry will have seen lots of stories pop out about a Ribble Ultra SLR, which I'm assuming you didn't quite custom paint yourself, but you, unless you've got this, unless that's not even a podcast booth you're in, it's a spray booth, but it's got amazing, wicked black and gold paint, and it's got those mad handlebars, which may or may not have been this probably the stiffest things, the most wrist jarring things on the planet. But how did you come by that Ribble? And the interesting thing to me was, how did you arrive at that paint? Because it's this connection which almost talks to what you were saying there about, you know, being cool is just doing what you love, to the Prince song, Starfish and Coffee.
Yeah, I mean, that was an idea of Sasha, who I've been dealing with at Ribble. She said, you know, have you got a song that you could like look at or refer to or think about when you're on your bike, when you're struggling going up one of those 12% hills or something like that? And there was this track on my favourite album by my favourite artist, Prince, the album Sign of the Times, called Starfish and Coffee. So I just put one of the lines in there on that. But my sort of introduction to Ribble, I went to the bike fair at Ali Pali a couple of years ago, and I was doing a Q&A with Jeff Thomas, who had raised, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds for cancer charities. Phenomenal, the things that he's done. But he had cycled in and around France and on his Ribble bike. And he had a red, white and blue one. It was predominantly white, but it was a beautiful pearlescent white with some blue and red decal on it. And I was like, wow, that is like one of the sexiest bikes that I've seen, even though it was, like I said, predominantly white, but it was the design, the forks, the handlebars. So I spoke about it whilst we were there at the show, and then went further into the show and then saw a similar bike in a pearlescent blue with gold. And I was like, this is like nothing I've ever seen before. And then started speaking to the guys at Ribble and the guys at Mavic that were there, and that's kind of where it started. So when we decided with Ribble that I was going to get on one, they said, like, right, what do you want to do paint wise do you want to go normal, or should we do something special? So here we are. And it's so special. It's so lovely.
So how often do you ride it, or is it a thing of beauty that is just polished and hung up over the mantelpiece next to various platinum records?
Well, I mean, there's not any platinum records hanging up.
Gold records, definitely some gold records. I thought you had some gold records, some garage compilations.
I have them, but they're just not hung up in the house. But from when I got the bike, the weather has been really bad. It's been really wet. So
yeah.
Sunday just gone was the first time Cynthia Rose went out on her maiden ride. So she's quick. She's gorgeous. And when the sun hits her, it's a real thing of beauty.
Explain the name there, Cynthia Rose.
So in that record that I spoke about, Starfish and Coffee, Prince talks about, the song's about a girl in his class who had autism, but he doesn't say it in such obvious terms, and her name was Cynthia Rose. So I just thought it'd be fitting to have Cynthia Rose as the name of the bike, considering we have a line from Starfish and Coffee on it as well.
Oh, nice. And you're taking it out on, you know, when it's not raining, you're taking the Ribble out. Who are you riding with? Who would people be surprised to know rides a bike in the kind of in the celebrity world of DJ Spoonie?
I mean, there's a couple of names that ride. I've not ridden with Pete Tong yet. Pete Tong's a big cyclist. MJ Cole, you know, one of the finest UK garage producers. He rides a lot. Mitchell Thomas is someone who I ride with all the time. He used to play for Spurs and Luton Town. they're sort of like, you know, Mitchell's like in my hardcore gang of regular cyclists, but you know, it's just like a lot of my friends that come out and we just enjoy our times out on the bike.
And where were you, you know, when you're sprinting for the stop sign kind of thing, or for the turning sign, where are you in that chain gap? Are you just like off the front? Are you just blowing out of your backside trying to keep up with some of your mates?
I mean, on this new bike, there's definitely a new sheriff in town. So I'm not sure whatever went on before, those leaderboards are going to change now. Yeah, it depends. Listen, if we're racing for a stop sign up a hill, I'll be near the back. But if we're on a flat, or if there's any sort of downhill gradient, then I'll try and be getting to near the front. But yeah, it's just that they're really good riders, really strong riders. We've got our little group has mixed abilities. You know, my girlfriend comes out and rides sometimes as well. DJ Zinc is someone else who I didn't mention just there, but
yeah.
I ride with Zinc quite a lot. He really enjoys it. Big up, Ben. it's a lovely little tribe we have.
Yeah, and how about when someone's got a mechanical? Are you rushing to their aid? Can you change a puncture? Can you sort out somebody's like unindexed gearing?
Can I sort out unindexed gearing? Most probably not. A puncture, most probably. Well, I could do a puncture.
Yeah.
But yeah, listen, it's all, my girlfriend and I went up to the Lake District with a lot of passion and not a lot of experience, and got a puncture at the top of like one of these, I'd say hills, but they're really more like mountains up there. But I was fine because I thought, I've got a spare inner tube, but actually I bought the wrong, the depth of my rims was too long for the inner tube that I had. So that was a bit of a schoolboy, but that only happens to you once, right? So
I don't know, you're literally talking my language. It might happen to you kind of 1 3/4 times. I went out for a ride yesterday and had exactly the same thing happened. But I had a valve extender, and this is a really boring esoteric story, so I might even chop this out, but I got some like old school, the vulcanizing rubber, right? That we used to fix our punches with as kids. Yeah. That's like my backup thing to fix a punch with. That had leaked inside my saddle pack and then like hardened inside the valve extender. So basically I've got this thing, I'm screwing it on and I'm like, cool, I'll be able to inflate it now. And then just nothing's happening with the pump. And it took me ages to work this out. And luckily I had a little pin with me and dug it out. But it's one of those moments where at the beginning, I this is like a very expensive test bike that doesn't belong to me. Luckily I was in a field. I just threw it into the verge. I was so incensed at this having happened. And then there's a moment where you're like, I'm at the top of a hill. I should technically be at work, but I'm not. I'm riding a bike. And it's a half-decent day in Bristol. And then you kind of have a moment. You're like, it's not all bad. And I wondered, like, you know, how would you describe to your mates, like, why you cycle? Is it something along those lines? Or is it like you just, you know, you've got a busy life, so it gets you out of your head? That's a classic one that people describe.
Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of things. Like I said, when I started, it was very much because of like getting that knee injury. But then you realise as you get older, that injuries are more likely to come frequently and take a lot longer to leave you as well. So I thought that cycling is a good way to maintain that fitness and keep the stress out of your ankles, your knees, your hips, your lower back. So on that basis, and I've said to people, you know, you can go as fast or as slow as you want, and you can build up. And it's a real good way of getting out into the countryside and taking in fresh air. And I didn't realise how social cycling really was. I thought you just get on it, you beast yourself, and then you don't. But there's a lot of chatting and a lot of camaraderie, and it's a real, real lovely community. And that's really why I've kept going and trying to grow our little beats and bikes massive. Do you know what I mean? So it's no hardship. I think we're lucky and privileged if we can get on our bike and we're fit, sound and mind to go out into the countryside with our nearest and dearest. That's really, it's a real luxury, it's a real privilege.
Absolutely. And as someone who's come to cycling, you know, later in life as an adult, you know, lots of cyclists I know, kind of you're born into it almost and you never really question it because you never see it from the outside. you just highlighted some of the really positive sides of cycling. What are the kind of weirder things where you're just like, man, you guys are weird. This is a strange sport.
I mean, when, and I'm sure at some point I will do it once I build up the confidence and the fitness, but when people say they go and do, you know, go to Mallorca and do the 250 and they're climbing for 2.5 hours, I'm like, you're like mad, and they go hill hunting. But that said, when I lived in London, where I was, there's loads of hills out there where you could go and do just some hill specific training, and I really got into doing that once or twice a week. And then when I was going out with the crew, I was just so strong because you're just used to doing, you know, 1,000 foot of climbing in 10 miles. That really was my training program. I'd do about 10 miles roughly, but there'll be over 1,000 foot of climbing in that short space of time. So maybe I'll get myself out to Mallorca. It is one of my favourite places in the world. So maybe I will become that mad cyclist and start hill hunting at some point.
I was going to say, I mean, you DJ all around the world, and, you know, I haven't ridden there, but I'm told that somewhere like Ibiza has some pretty decent roads. Do you take a bike? Would you take a bike, or do you hire bikes when you're away?
I haven't done that yet. And I'm going to try and do that towards the end of the season when it gets a little bit quieter on the roads out there. But I'm going to see if I can persuade a few of my friends to come over, and we'll try and cycle the island. My girlfriend and I and a couple of friends, a couple of years ago, we went to the Isle of Wight and cycled around that in a day. That was beautiful. Another friend of mine set up a business in France that we want to go out there and do a bit. So the bikes will be going in their new carry cases soon, and we're going to try and do some international cycling, absolutely.
Nice. Would you consider going out to somewhere like Flanders in Belgium to ride, you know, the really horrible, steep, cobbled bergs?
That's not really my idea of fun at this stage. You know what happens every time you conquer? You get over one challenge, you go and do another one. I do love some freshly laid tarmac. That is, you know, that's now become one of my favourite things in the world.
Yeah, which, you know, London's obviously famous for. Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting, but Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power, because you now have three energy sources for muscles: glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function, because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations, so head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
As a kind of sidestep, thinking about your career in, I don't know, would you say you have a career in media or as a broadcaster or as a presenter? Because you're so many things. I'm not sure how you'd sum yourself up, but how did you get started? I know we touched upon, you know, a bit of pirate radio and stuff, but how did you find your way into, yeah, being a household name?
I mean, the household name bit was kind of, it was never really a desire and ambition. It just, I suppose it happened as part of what else was going on. I'd always loved the radio growing up. Other than watching maybe sport, I love watching films and I love watching sport, but other than that, really, music and listening to radio was my thing. And, you know, the likes of Kenny Everett and Tony Blackburn and Steve Wright, RIP, Chris Tarrant, and a little bit later on, Chris Evans. These, I used to just listen and was fascinated with the radio and what they did. And then I got the opportunity to go into pirate radio and really wanted to kind of present my show in a more mainstream way, but with a non-mainstream music, in a way that most underground or specialist music wasn't being presented in that way. And I couldn't kind of understand as to why, because I wanted to be like, you know, Chris Tarrant or Kenny Everett, but playing garage. So that was really my thing. And then started out on a pirate radio station called London Underground, fell deeper in love with the medium and broadcasting. And then it just went from there, met Timmy and Mikey. We started the Dream Team. We then ended up with a radio show or three on Kiss, then Galaxy. And then at the turn of the millennium, we joined Radio One. And it's kind of just gone on from there, really. It's 7 years on Five Live, doing some football stuff. And a couple of years ago, joined Radio Two.
Blimey. What were those early days like doing pirate radio? I think that I maybe found myself listening to like the tail end of that. I'm sure, you know, pirate radio stations still exist, but it's a whole different ball game because of digital broadcasting. But, you know, there's people just do nothing TV series, which sort of brought back that idea back into the mainstream. Was it sort of running around on roofs, trying to put up aerials and sitting around in weed smoky bed sits trying to MC?
I mean, the aerials and the roofs bit wasn't for me. I was DJing, but there would have been some, you know, covert military operations, parking the car down the street, making sure you didn't go to the studio with a record box or a record bag, and making sure you didn't take too much stuff just in case you got raided, because they would at least take your records away from you. Yeah, there was a lot of drinking and a lot of smoking that went on, but I've never drunk and smoked. But the vibe of, you know, the vibe of the pirate radio station meant that, yeah, it was a great time. And I cannot imagine the music system, the culture, the music industry here without pirate radio. Pirate radio plays such an important role. And, you know, as a fully paid up member of the BBC, I'm not sure if I should be saying this, but the ecosystem of music in this country and how the cosmopolitan nature, especially in London, not exclusively to the capital, but it's interwoven into the fabric, I believe, and it's of paramount importance that we have cutting-edge music being able to be played, and in this case, broadcast. So I, you know, like I said, even though I'm on the BBC, which couldn't be further away from pirate radio, there would be no me as a broadcaster without pirate radio.
Yeah. And moving from London Underground to Kiss 100, which I guess was a sort of, that was a transition from the pirate to the commercial. Was that just some, you know, forward thinking regular person's like got their ear to the ground and like heard you and come knocking on the door and say, you're great, we want you to come onto our radio station and actually start getting paid for this? Or, you know, how did that transition go about? Because it is from that niche, that underground, into a more mainstream thing. And was there a feeling of, I don't know if I want to do this because this way I get to do it my way. And if I go with you guys, I'm suddenly doing it for you, potentially your way.
I mean, it was the natural progression. And I think it was a perfect storm of the genre of music that we were playing. And for Kiss, who were a cutting-edge dance music station, it was only right that they would have cutting-edge DJs broadcasting on their platform. At the time, they already had Matt Jam Lamont and Carl Tuff enough Brown joined before we did, but the genre was so big that there was more than enough room to have more than one sets of DJs playing that genre. And we had a slightly different style of playing as well, but like we joined there. And it was a big transition, but because we had specialist shows, there wasn't any restrictions on what we could play. And I think that when we're on the pirate station, not I think, but I know this, we weren't, you know, you wouldn't sort of swear or play records with obvious cursing. And so we already kind of formed and were professional in our sort of outlook. So it wasn't too much of a big transition to go from what we were doing to what we needed to do. The only difference is we could go into the studios with our record boxes and we could park our cars right outside the building and tell everybody where we were broadcasting from, because it didn't matter anymore, which was nice and refreshing, because, you know, as pirate radio DJs, you are breaking the law, even though technically in your head and in your heart, you don't feel like you're doing anything criminal. So, but yeah, that was it. And we, you know, like I said, we moved on we moved on from there. And yeah, the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that Starfish and Coffee track being really close to your heart, the one that's on your Ribble. What was a tune or an artist that, you know, really kind of spoke to you as a, you know, as a boy, I guess, you know, as a really young person that livened you or woke you up to thinking like, I just love music. This is what I want to do.
You know, that's such a, it's almost impossible to answer for me, because I think music, I have different records that are associated to different moods, that are associated to different times. And because music is so important to me, I'm very much able to sort of file my life in and around music. So I might talk about the importance of Madness and Baggy Trousers when I was at primary school, and then talk about the importance of discovering Luther Vandross, Prince, when I was a little bit older. And then as I got a little bit older, still falling in love with music that came out around the time when I was born, the Rare Groove soul and funk and disco. So it just depends on, you know, there could never be like one, I say there could never be one song, but Prince's Sign of the Times album is and will always be very special to me. I can remember still living at home and the cost of the album and actually buying the album for one track called The Ballad of Dorothy Parker, because it wasn't available as a single. I'd heard it. The only way you could get it was on the album. You know, and that'll always go down as my number one album. Off the Wall by Michael Jackson was my number two for many years. But I think Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life is now level pegging with Off the Wall. So, yeah, it's just like different times, different moods, different periods of my life. There'll be a slightly different soundtrack.
Yeah. And to motivate yourself when you're riding, whether you're riding on the road or at home, what would you listen to? What would get you like hyped?
It, you know, again, it depends. I've been told that I need to do more sort of zone two, zone three rides. So I'm not sort of pumping it out, getting into the yellow and the red. I'm keeping it in the blue and the green just to, so I'd most probably cycle with something a little bit more soulful, a bit more sing-along. If I'm really needing to go for it over a short period of time, jungle was quite good for that. Jungle and drum and bass definitely gets it moving.
Do you ever listen to Pendulum? Because those guys weirdly also love road cycling, I'm told.
Okay, I didn't know that. I mean, I if I had to choose between jungle and drum and bass, I love my jungle because the bass lines are closer associated to reggae music and what I was brought up on. And I know a few of the main protagonists from that scene. So yeah, I do love my jungle, and it's great, especially actually being at home if I'm on the turbo, where you tend to be working over a shorter period of time, a more intense ride. So yeah, that's what I would normally play if I'm on the bike indoors.
Yeah. And how do you sort of find new music, as it were? Like, who are your kind of tastemakers? I'm thinking, like, these days I do listen to an awful lot of radio, like I never did when I was younger, just because of things like iPlayer. So, like, I'm really into Jamie Cullum because he's just showing me the way with jazz and showing me where all these kind of...
He's like, a dude as well, by the way.
Is he? I imagine it, yeah. I love the fact that he came into jazz through just, like, samples on Tribe Called Quest and just, like, old hip-hop and stuff.
Yeah.
And then Giles Peterson's really good just for having an incredibly eclectic mix. Do you have those guys on your phone and you're just like, Giles, I'm bored. I'm bored of my Spotify best tracks playlist. Send me what you're listening to.
Not really, you know. I mean, I do know that they're there if I needed to, but for the length of time that I've been doing this, for how sort of vast my digital and vinyl collection is, I could go in my room now and pick out an album where I might have bought it for one record and put it on and find something else. And new music's new music. New music doesn't have to have just been released yesterday. New music is what's new to you. And I'm always discovering old music that's new to me. Discovered a Rufus and Chaka Khan record today that I absolutely love, and I didn't realise it was them.
So have you literally got so much vinyl, sometimes you're putting something on, you're like, can't remember ever having heard this.
Yeah, I do. I mean, and I still collect vinyl as well, so.
I saw a brilliant, I think it was on as an Instagram reel or something, of this Japanese guy. You know, Japanese just love, like, very like specific ways of doing things. I think that's like quite a cultural phenomenon. And obviously there's the whole kind of like background in particularly with vinyl, with like the Kisa bars and just people running a bar where there wasn't much, you know, audio equipment to go around after the Second World War. So it's just like a bloke with his hi-fi letting other people listen to it. And so this guy's got this like really old background in this. And he's such an audiophile. He's gone outside, he's gone to the nearest power line in his street to run power directly from the power line in this kind of pirate way, straight into his audio setup. So he doesn't have the hum of the exchange transformers that he says he can hear underneath and interrupting certain frequencies on his vinyl. Are you taking your vinyl that far?
I'm not taking it that far, but I have got a really beautiful listening room at home, which just has one turntable and all of my vinyl in it. And I feel really lucky and privileged to have that, because out of all of my friends that collect music, whenever they come to the house, they sit in the room and marvel at it. But it is like that guy in Japan. It's a beautiful thing to share. It's an experience that, even though I get some magic out of it on my own, it's nothing like when you're sitting there but with somebody and someone goes and picks another record out. You know, I love my record collection, but everyone has their own favourite artist and they'll go, oh, my God, you got this, or can I play this, or I've not seen this, and you put it on. It's just, it is the most amazing way to connect.
Yeah. How are they organised? Are they perfectly alphabetical? Are they just genre-based?
No, so it's genre based. So I have like my soul, funk, disco in one area that's alphabetical. Then I have my US house and garage in one place, and then my European house and garage in another.
Do you sort of miss, like, obviously you don't personally because you've got all this like hard media, but do you, you know, lament the passing of a time when, you know, once upon a time we were all making mixtapes and you bought those like mad massive, do you remember the tape packs off the back of raves, and they'd have like a dozen tapes in, and then CDs obviously came along, and then suddenly this thing called the iPod just sort of gently went, hey, that's all gone now. Do you sort of miss, is there a heyday that's now passed for music in terms of like the way we consume it?
I mean, if you just look through history, we're always trying to make our lives a little bit easier and a little bit more efficient. So, you know, we walked everywhere, then we discovered horses, then we started getting on horseback, then we discovered cars, and then we discovered faster cars.
And bicycles.
But then people go, actually, you know what? I'm going to go for a walk. And it goes back to where it started in many ways. And the last sort of 5-10 years, the resurgence of vinyl means that, yeah, people will collect and stream and download, but there seems to be the appreciation of that physical connection that you get from vinyl that you cannot get if you consume music in any other way. So, you know, even my stepson's 16, he now has a vinyl collection, which is most probably bigger than people who were 25 or 30, because 15 years ago, the explosion of CDs meant that that age group kind of missed vinyl, and the resurgence of vinyl through the likes of Taylor Swift and Beyonce, largely, that young people are now buying vinyl. And then you go on your own journey of discovery. So even though I might have the new Adele album or the new Beyonce album, I really liked Eminem. I'm going to try and find an Eminem album. And there it begins.
Yeah. Do you feel like you might start doing this with bikes? I'm thinking like with your Ribble, with the Pinarello you had before, you've got digital music in your bikes right there, especially the Ribble, right? You've got disc brakes. I think it's got a Duraace semi-wireless group set on it. Are you going to start buying old steel Italian frames?
Well, I mean, I have one.
Oh, yeah?
Already.
Yeah?
Yeah. But I haven't got the space. So what I'm doing with my bikes is definitely not what I do with my clothes, that if I'm going to get another bike or two, I need to get rid of one or two. So, yeah. But I love the look of them.
Yeah.
I even imagining what the old racers and pros were able to do on those bikes just blows my mind.
Yeah.
Just really blows my mind. So, yeah, it's lovely when you see one that's really, you know, it's well kept and well looked after. One of the guys that I ride with, Simon, it's not an all steel frame, but it's not aero designed. And I always, when I can get next to him and catch him, I always have a marvel at his bike.
Oh, no. So what's the frame that you've got?
I can't even remember what mine's called. It's a German bike. I can't even remember what it's called. It's actually not even, it's not a road bike. It's more of a kind of a cruiser, or what I would call a cruiser. It's more of a kind of hybrid. If I'm going to pop down to a coffee shop as opposed to going out and doing 30 off, I would never do a long distance on it. But yeah, that's the most traditional looking. It's got like a Brooks leather saddle on it. And
nice. So basically by the time you're 90, the saddle should be just about broken in.
Just broken in. That said, you know, the more you ride, you know, the less pain you get around the back.
It's true. I think that's something to do with just like all of your nerve endings just deadening. It's like when like Muay Thai fighters just kick lampposts so that their shins become really tough. I don't know if it's good or bad, but it is helpful. But do you have a, you know, as we talked about, big into golf, really into football, big Liverpool supporter. Do you have a similar or growing passion with cycle racing at all? Or is that just like, no, that's just a bridge too far? You're not watching the Tour de France in the summer.
Yeah, you know what? I don't watch it avidly like that. But there have been times when I've gone in like my local bike shop in Bedford and found myself watching it a lot longer than I would have if I was at home. So maybe like being in the environment, or I guess if we do take the bikes abroad and we'll end up somewhere watching. But yeah, I have sat and watched it, but I don't sit and watch it all the time if I'm at home. If it's on and I see it, then I'll definitely tune in and have a little bit. But like I said, it just blows my mind that they're going up a hill the speed they are,
yeah,
when that's my sort of flat speed. And they're racing up a hill. It blows my mind.
It is just insane. If it's any consolation, though, if you're riding kind of like in the middle of the pack, say you've got 50 riders and you're about two-thirds of the way down in the middle, you're basically putting in about 15% of the effort of the guy right at the front. And even the guy at the front is getting a slight effect from the two, say if it was like a triangle formation,
yeah,
from the two people behind that rider, because they create a bow wake. So they're pushing air. It's like going and blowing. So they're slightly pushing that person forward. Not to diminish the fact that it is just absolutely nails what they do, but it is kind of mind-blowing. Like that. And this, you know, that's another question. Like, do you get into the kind of, do you start getting into like the tech of cycling, or are you like, nah, that's just, you know, I want to do this for fun, not to try and get aero gains.
No, I want to get the gains, man. And the tech and the learning from the tech and the numbers. And, you know, coming from football, I'm also aware that the numbers aren't everything. Like, you can't make it totally stat-based, but they can give you indicators if you want them. So, like, for instance, last year when I did Ride London, and I had my time was slower than, I compared it to one of my mates. My time was slower than his, but my average wattage was way more than his. But then I rode on my own a lot longer than he did. So if I had put that same amount of effort and ridden in a bit of a group, I would have done a much, much quicker time.
Yeah.
So the strength is there, and it's good then to be able to look at it and analyze it in that way. So yeah, I'm looking forward to doing Ride London again, actually, so I'm going to slip in and stay in some groups.
Oh, nice. You're doing it this year?
Yeah, I want to try and average 20 mile an hour over the 100 miles. That's my target.
Boom. I think it's very doable. Do you feel like, sort of a little sidestep here, thinking about like the numbers and like the whole idea in cycling that's been bandied around for ages that came up after the 2012 Olympics, you know, marginal gains, all centered around this guy, Dave Brailsford. And now with your football hat on, what do you make of Jim Ratcliffe, who owns Ineos Grenadiers? And he also owns like a stake in Mercedes F1. He owns the Ben Ainslie sailing team. He's got a lot of fingers in a lot of sports pies. Bringing his man, Dave Brailsford, across to Manchester United, floundering away, you know, the fifth place or something at the moment. Just is that a Does that make sense to you, taking a guy from cycling who does cycling numbers and putting him in a position of something like, is he like football operations something or other? You know, it's a money ball sort of move.
It's a money ball move. Money ball doesn't always work in football. It will work to a certain degree, right? So there will be an element of science to all of it. But there's an element to football where you are, if I say you are still at the behest of your opponent, as opposed to when you're cycling, you're racing against each other, but the other cyclist is not or shouldn't be trying to stop you from cycling. Whereas in football, you can have the best plans in the world, but that other team are working against, they're against you, they're working against you in a way that the peloton also know that when you slip into the peloton, we're all helping each other. On a football pitch, the team in red are not helping the team in blue. So how he gets his head around that, or how those numbers then work out when you're competing directly against someone, it's going to be interesting. The other thing is, well, that Manchester United comes with a massive amount of expectation, that their fans are used to winning. They're one of the biggest football clubs in the world. So the time that they're going to have to bring in, incorporate all of these new ideas, will they get the time if they don't start bearing fruit immediately? All of that's to be played out. However, it's good to have a structure. It's good to have a plan that they can work from. But football is a little bit more complicated than that at the top end.
Yeah.
If they were a mid-table side that were looking, right, we're looking to just survive in the Premier League, we are going to use our numbers to buy players that play in our system and then sell them on, so it becomes a business in that sense, then it could work. But when you get to the higher echelons of competing in the Premier League or in Europe, it's not going to be so scientific by way of like Moneyball.
Yeah. And do you see, or how do you perceive kind of moves by people like Jim Ratcliffe into buying up parts of large football clubs? He's a guy who effectively makes his money through petrochemicals. And then we've got lots of, in cycling, there's a big debate around investment from the Middle East. So you've got kind of nation states, you know, you've got Team UAE, right? So Tadej Pogacar, one of the greatest cyclists in cycling, heading up this team, which also incidentally bought Colnago Bikes, an Italian heritage mark. So they're kind of consolidating real cycling talent and real cycling pedigree, but in a way where it's almost like a kind of land grab. That's how some people see it. And, you know, the word this is all summed up with is sports washing or greenwashing. Is that something that you sort of see happening in sport, do you think? Would you subscribe to ideas like that? Or do you just think this is just capitalist, like commerce, right? It's, you know, money talks, and if you got it, you can go and use it.
And I think really what you said there, James, is kind of like the way that it is. It's like the biggest person in the playground dictates the rules of the game. And whether it's the Middle East that are doing this now because they have money and oil, but the West, you know, the West have done it for centuries. You know, when Europe were the first people really to make boats that could travel for days and days, they went around, you know, colonizing places in the Caribbean and in Africa that they had really no right to do, but they had the power and influence to do it. Now it's not so much about gunpowder, but it's about oil. And now I guess they're effectively doing the same thing, but it's, like I said, it's the biggest and strongest in the playground wins, to maybe put it as sort of politically correct or as succinctly as I can. And look, if sport grows and we can keep the integrity of sport at the same time, then is it really a bad thing? Because if it's not money coming in from the Middle East, what's the difference between the Middle East money and American money or South American money or British money? Or, you know, there will be people who are fans of Manchester United that don't want Jim Ratcliffe coming in and buying their club. It's just one of those things. I think that there's certain fans of Newcastle United that wish that their club was fan owned and not owned by not owned by the Saudis either. So it's just it's the modern way. And like, as long as the integrity of the sport doesn't suffer and we can grow the sport at the same time, then I'm not sure how, not bothered, that's not really the right way to put it, but in the context of how the world, the infrastructure of the world, the setup of the world and how it has been for centuries, this is just how it is now.
Yeah. So where would you sort of stand on ideas of, you know, someone like with the Qatar World Cup where you have Beckham going and then Lineker being incredibly outspoken about not wanting to go and be a part of a country that has terrible human rights records? Is that, are we crossing a line there with kind of taking political stances, or should someone like Beckham take his soapbox and really use it and say, look guys, I'm going to keep this at arm's length, because actually there's some fairly dodgy practices, like known dodgy practices that have gone on, that have gone into producing this World Cup?
I mean, again, we can really go off on a tangent here, because when we look at what dodgy practices and human rights violations, no one would be saying anything if the World Cup was held in America.
Yeah.
But yet, 3-4 years ago, a man was effectively strangled by an officer of the law, someone who's meant to be protecting, on those streets. So where are the human rights in somewhere that is meant to be a first world country? Then who are we to decide what is human rights and what aren't? You know, here in England as well, we have people who are sleeping on the streets whilst there are buildings that are empty. You know, is this, where are their human rights? There are people that are incarcerated for crimes that they didn't commit, or because they didn't have access to good representation in court, they get sent to prison. And people who do have access to the best lawyers that money can buy have avoided prison. Is that fair? Like, or because you're born poor, you're always going to be at a disadvantage? So, you know, this is why sometimes I stand back and say, listen, if it's Beckham or if it's Lineker and they feel passionately or strongly about a particular subject, then that is you. But just be very careful that whilst you're pointing the finger, or if you are pointing the finger at somebody else, that are you a part of the problem or a part of the solution? Because, like I said, I don't think for a second that us in the West are without fault ever, you know. And, you know, I reckon if you look through history, I say that the West is responsible for a lot of the wrongs that have gone on in the world, you know.
Absolutely. I apologise, I feel like I've taken this podcast into a strange direction that maybe we...
James, these things matter. These are the kind of conversations that we have with our friends. And like I said, it's, we also have to be, you know, very aware that whilst we're consuming information, what is that information that we're consuming? Is that all of the information? Do we have all of the story? Do we have all of the picture? Why were we not told that? So once you then can come to the point that, or the conclusion that we're not told everything all the time, then you can ask yourself, why are we not told everything all the time? Then you get into another realm where it's like, well, actually, are we in a position to be saying anything to anyone? Yeah, we do get, you know, we might have employment rights better than some countries, but speak to women who are 60, 70 years old now, even 40 years old now, and ask them, do they feel that they have a fair crack in the workplace? A high percentage of those will say no. So there's a human rights issue straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just even thinking of that subject through a kind of like cycling lens and sport lens, just seeing the explosion of women's football and of women's cycling, and then thinking like, that shouldn't kind of cover up the fact that, hang on, this has been happening for a long time. Why only now is it a cynical move to ultimately put, you know, raise these sports up in a way where they've previously been ignored? Because is the only reason you do that to make sure that you're on the right side of history now, as a broadcaster or as a team manager or team owner kind of thing? Or do you just go, well, do you know what? Something's better than nothing. So it doesn't matter why it's happening, as long as it is happening, because it's definitely worse when it's not. But yeah, I definitely hear you with there's a massive amount of hypocrisy.
Yeah, and you know, and I can turn around and say as a black British man who, you know, was born in the 70s and who's faced a bit of racism, but not loads and loads, but I'm aware of it more than it was directly at my feet. And I know what it's like to be on the other side. I also have two daughters. So again, I understand what it's like for them, that it's very much a man's world. So when we start talking about human rights and equality and fairness, like, I could talk about it forever because it is, it's my life. So then when I'm being told that I shouldn't like them over there because they are sports washing or whatever, I'm like, well, wait a minute, we've got our own stuff that we need to be discussing. Like, why did it take me so long to get promoted? If I was as able as I was and white, would I have been promoted sooner? So, you know, why aren't we having that conversation first? And then once we've got our own house completely in order, then we can look to tell other people what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, Spoonie, thank you very much. That's very, very insightful. Not a place I thought we would end up going. So maybe just to finish on a slightly lighter note, we had, it hasn't gone out yet, this podcast, mind you, but we had Krishnan Gurumurthy, the Channel 4 newsreader, on the podcast a while ago. And he, like you, is really into cycling. And he, like you, also did Strictly Come Dancing. And he said it was, A, one of the best things he's ever done, B, put him in incredible shape. But what he hasn't done or didn't do was the Men's Health 6-pack in 6 weeks challenge. So it's not for everybody. So first question is, do you still have your 6-pack? And of those three things, hitting the gym really hard and changing your diet for 6 weeks, cycling, or Strictly Come Dancing, which has put you in kind of the best shape?
Strictly would definitely come third out of those three.
Okay.
I love training in the gym because it helps my cycling, and my cycling helps my gymming. So I see those two, even though they're independent, they're intrinsically linked, especially the way that I train. So yeah, it's hard to differentiate between the two. Like, I box, and when I did that Men's Health article, I said that I didn't really have any interest just to go into the gym to lift weights, but I'd like to see how my body would look if I was boxing. So yeah, boxing's a phenomenal sport for, you know, for strength and conditioning, just like cycling is for conditioning.
Absolutely. And do you ever do yoga? I'm told that Goldie is really into hot yoga.
He's unbelievable. He's like, I mean, wherever he goes in the world, he will find a yoga studio. I used to do quite a bit of it, but now my hip flexors, my IT bands are like cold elastic. They really need stretching. And I've started just subtly stretching a bit more. Whenever I stretch in front of my girlfriend, which I've now said I'm going to stop, she just bursts into fits of laughter because I'm not the most supple kid on the block.
And I hope you're doing it in your lycra as well. I do it in front of my partner sometimes. And yeah, she, you know, we can swear, but she pisses herself.
and you know, the thing is, James, we're not built the same. Like, men have to work at being supple in a way that, typically speaking, women have to work at being strong. So if I say to my girlfriend, all right, you can hold that yoga pose for 5 minutes, but can you do 2 pull-ups? She'll say no. Where for us, we could do the 2 pull-ups, but we can't hold the yoga pose for 1 minute. It's just kind of how it is.
That is how it is. Well, DJ Spoonie, thank you so much for the chat. Thank you so much for joining us on the Cyclist Magazine podcast.
Nice one. And I want to say a hello to OJ Borge, who's one of my Radio 2 colleagues, who is an absolute beast on the bike. And I know he'll see and listen to this podcast. So big up, OJ.
OJ, well, you heard it here first. An absolute beast on the bike. Right. Well, I'll tell you what, just start investing some more money in some aero kit. Just get a skin suit, right? That is the absolute most bang for your buck.
That really,
the first thing is your actual position on a bike, right? Because you're 80% of the drag. So go and get a bike fit, work out the best, most aero place you can sit, where you can sit on a bike while still maintaining a decent power output, because it gets harder the lower you get. Then get a skin suit, because that is, yeah, it just makes you very, very slippery. You know, something like a dolphin is much more hydrodynamic than a turtle, a sea turtle kind of thing. And then, yeah, just really splash out and get one of those ridiculous TT helmets that we're seeing quite a lot of. And you'll be well away. OJ will have nothing on you.
I want to get a new helmet. I'm going to get a new helmet. I'm going to see what Mavic have got by way of a nice black nice black lid.
Excellent. And some more Prince lyrics to go around it.
There you go.
DJ Spoonie, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, didn't necessarily think that our chat would go in that direction. I hope you guys listened to the end and I hope you appreciated it, or at least appreciated where we were both coming from. We try not to be political on the Cyclist Magazine podcast, not because we don't like politics, but because, you know, you haven't necessarily come for that. You've got Rory Stewart and Alistair on The Rest Is Politics for that. So yeah, we like to stick to cycling, but we did end up straight into the world of politics. And yeah, I really appreciated Spoonie's insights, because he does come from a background of a broadcasting where he can really articulate things well, but also a background of sport, and he's been around in the best possible sense for a long time. So I think he's got a different kind of handle, and it's nice to chat. I think anyway, I found it nice to chat to somebody who is a cyclist out of passion as opposed to background, but still love sport. So it's that different kind of angle. So yeah, just from me, Spoonie, I doubt you listen to this, because I don't know. I don't even listen to my own podcast half the time, because it's weird hearing your own voice, isn't it? If you haven't done that for a while, try it, record it, and then freak out how you really sound. So I don't begrudge you if you haven't actually listened to this episode. That's totally fine. I think a lot of actors as well don't even watch their own movies. But if you do, thank you very much for coming on the Cyclist Magazine podcast. It was a real treat. I do hope our paths cross again, and I do hope you get out on your ribble and you start ticking off some local KOMs and kicking your mate's ass in the chain gang. Something tells me you're a pretty strong rider. But anyway, enough of that. Time for me to go. Got to get back to my day job. That's making magazines, making the Cyclist Magazine. There's another plug for you. I'm just writing about a chap called James McDonald, who is an ultra endurance cyclist who has just taken on the 100-mile record. So how fast can you pedal 100 miles on an indoor velodrome? And blimey, it sounds incredibly hard. It's 644 laps of a 250-meter track. That's a long way. I mean, it's 100 miles. It says so in the record, but that's a long time. Anyway, better get back to it. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you again, this time with William Strickson, recovered from his bout of illness, in a fortnight's time, where we've got another really excellent guest lined up for you guys. Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting, but Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power, because you now have three energy sources for muscles: glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function, because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations, so head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that CYCLIST isn't just a podcast. No, CYCLIST is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist Magazine subscription offers.